right there. He had been a comfort to me, so I said it looked lovely, but I didn't see anything. It's real nice, Jim. Under my arms, too, he said. Going out for football next year. Scout, don't let Auntie aggravate you. It seemed only yesterday that he was telling me not to aggravate Auntie. You know she's not used to girls, said Jim. Leastways, not girls like you. She's trying to make you a lady. Can't you take up sewing or something? Hell no! She doesn't like me. That's all there is to it, and I don't care. It was her calling Walter Cunningham trash that got me going, Jim. Not what she said about being a problem to Atticus. We got that all straight one time. I asked him if I was a problem, and he said not much of one. At most, one that he could always figure out, and not to worry my head a second about bothering him. No, it was Walter. That boy's not trash, Jim. He ain't like the Yules. Jim kicked off his shoes and swung his feet to the bed. He propped himself against a pillow and switched on the reading light. You know something, Scout? I've got it all figured out now. I've thought about it a lot lately, and I've got it figured out. There's four kinds of folks in the world. There's the ordinary kind, like us and the neighbors. There's the kind like the Cunninghams out in the woods. The kind like the Yules down at the dump. And the Negroes. What about the Chinese and the Cajuns down yonder in Baldwin County? I mean in Macon County. The thing about it is, our kind of folks don't like the Cunninghams. The Cunninghams don't like the Yules. And the Yules hate and despise the colored folks. I told Jim if that was so, then why didn't Tom's jury, made up of folks like the Cunninghams, acquit Tom to spite the Yules? Jim waved my question away as being infantile. You know, he said, I've seen Atticus pat his foot when there's fiddling on the radio, and he loves pot liquor better than any man I ever saw. Then that makes us like the Cunninghams, I said. I can't see why, Auntie. No, let me finish. It does, but we're still different somehow. Atticus said one time the reason Auntie's so hipped on the family is because all we've got's background and not a dime to our names. Well, Jim, I don't know. Atticus told me one time that most of this old family stuff's foolishness, because everybody's family's just as old as everybody else's. I said, did that include the colored folks and Englishmen? And he said yes. Background doesn't mean old family, said Jim. I think it's how long your family's been reading and writing. Scout, I've studied this real hard. And that's the only reason I can think of. Somewhere along when the finches were in Egypt, one of 'em must have learned a hieroglyphic or two, and he taught his boy. Jim laughed. Imagine Auntie being proud her great-granddaddy could read and write. Ladies pick funny things to be proud of. Well, I'm glad he could, or who'd have taught Atticus and them? And if Atticus couldn't read, you and me'd be in a fix. I don't think that's what background is, Jim. Well, then, how do you explain why the Cunninghams are different? Mr. Walter can hardly sign his name. I've seen him. We've just been reading and writing longer than they have. No, everybody's got to learn. Nobody's born knowing. That Walter's as smart as he can be. He just gets held back sometimes because he has to stay out and help his daddy. Nothing's wrong with him. No, Jim, I think there's just one kind of folks. Folks. Jim turned around and punched his pillow. When he settled back, his face was cloudy. He was going into one of his declines, and I grew wary. His brows came together. His mouth became a thin line. He was silent for a while. "That's what I thought, too," he said at last, "when I was your age. If there's just one kind of folks, why can't they get along with each other? If they're all alike, why do they go out of their way to despise each other?" "Scout, I think I'm beginning to understand something. I think I'm beginning to understand why Boo Radley stayed shut up in the house all this time. It's because he wants to stay inside." Chapter 24. Calpurnia wore her stiffest starched apron. She carried a tray of charlotte. She backed up to the swinging door and pressed gently. I admired the ease and grace with which she handled heavy loads of dainty things. So did Aunt Alexandra, I guess, because she had let Calpurnia serve today. August was on the brink of September. Dill would be leaving for Meridian tomorrow. Today he was off with Jem at Barker's Eddy. Jem had discovered with angry amazement that nobody had ever bothered to teach Dill how to swim, a skill Jem considered necessary as walking. They had spent 2 afternoons at the creek. They said they were going in naked, and I couldn't come. So I divided the lonely hours between Calpurnia and Miss Morty. Today Aunt Alexandra and her missionary circle were fighting the good fight all over the house. From the kitchen, I heard Mrs. Grace Merriweather giving a report in the living room on the squalid lives of the Marooners, it sounded like to me. They put the women out in huts when their time came, whatever that was. They had no sense of family. I knew that'd distress Auntie. They subjected children to terrible ordeals when they were 13. They were crawling with yaws and earworms. They chewed up and spat out the bark of a tree into a communal pot and then got drunk on it. Immediately thereafter, the ladies adjourned for refreshments. I didn't know whether to go into the dining room or stay out. Aunt Alexandra told me to join them for refreshments. It was not necessary that I attend the business part of the meeting. She said it'd bore me. I was wearing my pink Sunday dress, shoes, and a petticoat, and reflected that if I spilled anything, Calpurnia would have to wash my dress again for tomorrow. This had been a busy day for her. I decided to stay out. "Can I help you, Cal?" I asked, wishing to be of some service. Calpurnia paused in the doorway. "You be still as a mouse in that corner," she said, "and you can help me load up the trays when I come back." The gentle hum of ladies' voices grew louder as she opened the door. "Why, Alexandra, I never saw such charlotte. Just lovely. I never can get my crust like this. Never can. Who'd have thought of little dewberry tarts? Calpurnia? Who'd have thought it? Anybody tell you that the preacher's wife's... No. Well, she is. And that other one not walking yet." They became quiet, and I knew they had all been served. Calpurnia returned and put my mother's heavy silver pitcher on a tray. "This coffee pitcher's a curiosity," she murmured. "They don't make 'em these days." "Can I carry it in?" "If you be careful and don't drop it. Set it down at the end of the table by Miss Alexandra. Down there by the cups and things. She's gonna pour." I tried pressing my behind against the door as Calpurnia had done, but the door didn't budge. Grinning, she held it open for me. "Careful now. It's heavy. Don't look at it and you won't spill it." My journey was successful. Aunt Alexandra smiled brilliantly. "Stay with us, Jean Louise," she said. This was a part of her campaign to teach me to be a lady. It was customary for every circle hostess to invite her neighbors in for refreshments, be they Baptists or Presbyterians, which accounted for the presence of Miss Rachel, sober as a judge, Miss Morty, and Miss Stephanie Crawford. Rather nervous, I took a seat beside Miss Morty and wondered why ladies put on their hats to go across the street. Ladies in bunches always filled me with vague apprehension and a firm desire to be elsewhere. But this feeling was what Aunt Alexandra called being spoiled. The ladies were cool in fragile pastel prints. Most of them were heavily powdered but unrouged. The only lipstick in the room was Tangy Natural. Cutex Natural sparkled on their fingernails, but some of the younger ladies wore rose. They smelled heavenly. I sat quietly, having conquered my hands by tightly gripping the arms of the chair, and waited for someone to speak to me. Miss Morty's gold bridgework twinkled. "You're mighty dressed up, Miss Jean Louise," she said. "Where are your breeches today?"
"Under my dress." I hadn't meant to be funny, but the ladies laughed. My cheeks grew hot as I realized my mistake, but Miss Morty looked gravely down at me. She never laughed at me unless I meant to be funny. In the sudden silence that followed, Miss Stephanie Crawford called from across the room, "What you going to be when you grow up, Jean Louise? A lawyer?"
"No, I hadn't thought about it," I answered, grateful that Miss Stephanie was kind enough to change the subject. Hurriedly, I began choosing my vocation. Nurse? Aviator?
"Well, why, shoot, I thought you wanted to be a lawyer. You've already commenced going to court."
The ladies laughed again. "That Stephanie's a card," somebody said. Miss Stephanie was encouraged to pursue the subject.
"Don't you want to grow up to be a lawyer?"
Miss Morty's hand touched mine, and I answered mildly enough,
"No, just a lady."
Miss Stephanie eyed me suspiciously, decided that I meant no impertinence, and contented herself with,
"Well, you won't get very far until you start wearing dresses more often."
Miss Morty's hand closed tightly on mine, and I said nothing. Its warmth was enough. Mrs. Grace Merriweather sat on my left, and I felt it would be polite to talk to her. Mr. Merriweather, a faithful Methodist under duress, apparently saw nothing personal in singing "Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound That Saved a Wretch Like Me." It was the general opinion of Maycomb, however, that Mrs. Merriweather had sobered him up and made a reasonably useful citizen of him. For certainly Mrs. Merriweather was the most devout lady in Maycomb. I searched for a topic of interest to her.
"What did you all study this afternoon?" I asked.
"Oh, child, those poor marooners," she said, and was off. Few other questions would be necessary.
Mrs. Merriweather's large brown eyes always filled with tears when she considered the oppressed.
"Living in that jungle with nobody but J. Grimes Everett," she said. "Not a white person'll go near 'em but that saintly J. Grimes Everett."
Mrs. Merriweather played her voice like an organ. Every word she said received its full measure.
"The poverty, the darkness, the immorality. Nobody but J. Grimes Everett knows. You know, when the church gave me that trip to the campgrounds, J. Grimes Everett said to me,
'Was he there, ma'am? I thought
home on leave.' J. Grimes Everett said to me, he said, 'Mrs. Merriweather, you have no conception, no conception of what we are fighting over there.' That's what he said to me."
"Yes, ma'am."
I said to him, "Mr. Everett," I said, "the ladies of the Maycomb, Alabama Methodist Episcopal Church South
are behind you 100%. That's what I said to him. And you know, right then and there, I made a pledge in my heart. I said to myself, when I go home, I'm going to give a course on the Marooners and bring J. Grimes Everett's message to make 'em. And that's just what I'm doing. Yes, ma'am. When Mrs. Merriweather shook her head, her black curls jiggled. Jean Louise, she said, you are a fortunate girl. You live in a Christian home with Christian folks in a Christian town. Out there in J. Grimes Everett's land, there's nothing but sin and squalor.
Yes, ma'am.
Sin and squalor.
What was that, Gertrude? Mrs. Merriweather turned on her chimes for the lady sitting beside her.
Oh, that. Well, I always say forgive and forget. Forgive and forget. Thing that church ought to do is help her lead a Christian life for those children from here on out. Some of the men ought to go out there and tell that preacher to encourage her.
Excuse me, Mrs. Merriweather, I interrupted. Are you all talking about Mayella Yule?
No, child. That darky's wife. Tom's wife. Tom
Robinson, ma'am.
Mrs. Merriweather turned back to her neighbor. There's one thing I truly believe, Gertrude, she continued, but some people just don't see it my way. If we just let them know we forgive 'em, that we've forgotten it, then this whole thing'll blow over.
Mrs. Merriweather, I interrupted once more, what'll blow over?
Again she turned to me. Mrs. Merriweather was one of those childless adults who find it necessary to assume a different tone of voice when speaking to children. Nothing, Jean Louise, she said in stately largo. The cooks and field hands are just dissatisfied, but they're settling down now. They grumbled all next day after that trial. Mrs. Merriweather faced Mrs. Farrow. Gertrude, I tell you, there's nothing more distracting than a sulky darky. Their mouths go down to here. Just ruins your day to have one of 'em in the kitchen. You know what I said to my Sophie, Gertrude? I said, Sophie, I said, you simply are not being a Christian today. Jesus Christ never went around grumbling and complaining. And you know, it did her good. She took her eyes off that floor and said, no, Miss Merriweather, Jesus never went around grumbling. I tell you, Gertrude, you never ought to let an opportunity go by to witness for the Lord. I was reminded of the ancient little organ in the chapel at Finch's Landing. When I was very small, and if I had been very good during the day, Atticus would let me pump its bellows while he picked out a tune with one finger. The last note would linger as long as there was air to sustain it. Mrs. Merriweather had run out of air, I judged, and was replenishing her supply while Mrs. Farrow composed herself to speak. Mrs. Farrow was a splendidly built woman with pale eyes and narrow feet. She had a fresh, permanent wave, and her hair was a mass of tight gray ringlets. She was the second most devout lady in Macomb. She had a curious habit of prefacing everything she said with a soft, sibilant sound. Grace, she said, it's just like I was telling Brother Hudson the other day. Brother Hudson, I said, looks like we are fighting a losing battle. A losing battle. I said, it doesn't matter to 'em one bit. We can educate 'em till we're blue in the face. We can try till we drop to make Christians out of 'em. But there's no lady safe in her bed these nights. He said to me, Mrs. Farrow, I don't know what we're coming to down here. So I told him that was certainly a fact. Mrs. Merriweather nodded wisely. Her voice soared over the clink of coffee cups and the soft bovine sounds of the ladies munching their dainties. "Gertrude," she said, "I tell you there are some good but misguided people in this town. Good but misguided. Folks in this town who think they're doing right, I mean. Now, far be it from me to say who, but some of 'em in this town thought they were doing the right thing a while back, but all they did was stir 'em up. That's all they did. Might have looked like the right thing to do at the time. I'm sure I don't know. I'm not read in that field, but sulky, dissatisfied. I tell you, if my Sophie'd kept it up another day, I'd have let her go. It's never entered that wool of hers that the only reason I keep her is because this depression's on, and she needs her dollar and a quarter every week she can get it. His food doesn't stick going down, does it?" Miss Morty said it. Two tight lines had appeared at the corners of her mouth. She had been sitting silently beside me, her coffee cup balanced on one knee. I had lost the thread of conversation long ago when they quit talking about Tom Robinson's wife, and had contented myself with thinking of Finch's Landing and the river. Aunt Alexandra had got it backwards. The business part of the meeting was blood-curdling. The social hour was dreary. "Morty, I'm sure I don't know what you mean," said Mrs. Merriweather. "I'm sure you do," Miss Morty said shortly. She said no more. When Miss Morty was angry, her brevity was icy. Something had made her deeply angry, and her gray eyes were as cold as her voice. Mrs. Merriweather reddened, glanced at me, and looked away. I could not see Mrs. Farrow. Aunt Alexandra got up from the table and swiftly passed more refreshments, neatly engaging Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Gates in brisk conversation. When she had them well on the road with Mrs. Perkins, Aunt Alexandra stepped back. She gave Miss Morty a look of pure gratitude, and I wondered at the world of women. Miss Morty and Aunt Alexandra had never been especially close, and here was Auntie silently thanking her for something. For what? I knew not. I was content to learn that Aunt Alexandra could be pierced sufficiently to feel gratitude for help given. There was no doubt about it. I must soon enter this world, where on its surface fragrant ladies rocked slowly, fanned gently, and drank cool water. But I was more at home in my father's world. People like Mr. Heck Tate did not trap you with innocent questions to make fun of you. Even Jem was not highly critical, unless you said something stupid. Ladies seemed to live in faint horror of men, seemed unwilling to approve wholeheartedly of them. But I liked them. There was something about them. No matter how much they cussed and drank and gambled and chewed, no matter how undelectable they were, there was something about them that I instinctively liked. They weren't hypocrites, Mrs. Perkins, born hypocrites, Mrs. Merriweather was saying. At least we don't have that sin on our shoulders down here. People up there set 'em free, but you don't see 'em setting at the table with 'em. At least we don't have the deceit to say to 'em, 'Yes, you're as good as we are, but stay away from us.' Down here, we just say, 'You live your way, and we'll live ours.' I think that woman, that Mrs. Roosevelt's, lost her mind. Just plain lost her mind coming down to Birmingham and trying to sit with 'em. If I was the mayor of Birmingham, I'd—" Well, neither of us was the mayor of Birmingham, but I wished I was the governor of Alabama for one day. I'd let Tom Robinson go so quick the Missionary Society wouldn't have time to catch its breath. Calpurnia was telling Miss Rachel's cook the other day how bad Tom was taking things, and she didn't stop talking when I came into the kitchen. She said there wasn't a thing Atticus could do to make being shut up easier for him, that the last thing he said to Atticus before they took him down to the prison camp was, "Goodbye, Mr. Finch. There ain't nothing you can do now, so there ain't no use trying." Calpurnia said Atticus told her that the day they took Tom to prison, he just gave up hope. She said Atticus tried to explain things to him, and that he must do his best not to lose hope, because Atticus was doing his best to get him free. Miss Rachel's cook asked Calpurnia, "Why didn't Atticus just say, 'Yes, you'll go free,' and leave it at that? Seemed like that'd be a big comfort to Tom." Calpurnia said, "Because you ain't familiar with the law. First thing you learn when you're in a lawing family is that there ain't any definite answers to anything. Mr. Finch couldn't say something so when he doesn't know for sure it's so." The front door slammed, and I heard Atticus's footsteps in the hall. Automatically, I wondered what time it was. Not nearly time for him to be home, and on Missionary Society days, he usually stayed downtown until black dark. He stopped in the doorway. His hat was in his hand, and his face was white. "Excuse me, ladies," he said. "Go right ahead with your meeting. Don't let me disturb you. Alexandra, could you come to the kitchen a minute? I want to borrow Calpurnia for a while." He didn't go through the dining room, but went down the back hallway and entered the kitchen from the rear door. Aunt Alexandra and I met him. The dining room door opened again, and Miss Morty joined us. Calpurnia had half risen from her chair. "Cal," Atticus said, "I want you to go with me out to Helen Robinson's house." "What's the matter?" Aunt Alexandra asked, alarmed by the look on my father's face. "Tom's dead." Aunt Alexandra put her hands to her mouth. "They shot him," said Atticus. "He was running. It was during their exercise period. They said he just broke into a blind, raving charge at the fence and started climbing over, right in front of them."
"Didn't they try to stop him? Didn't they give him any warning?"
Aunt Alexandra's voice shook. "Oh, yes. The guards called to him to stop. They fired a few shots in the air, then to kill. They got him just as he went over the fence. They said if he'd had two good arms, he'd have made it. He was moving that fast. 17 bullet holes in him. They didn't have to shoot him that much. Cal, I want you to come out with me and help me tell Helen."
"Yes, sir,"
she murmured, fumbling at her apron. Miss Morty went to Calpurnia and untied it.
"This is the last straw, Atticus," Aunt Alexandra said.
"Depends on how you look at it," he said. "What was one Negro, more or less, among 200 of them? He wasn't Tom to them. He was an escaping prisoner." Atticus leaned against the refrigerator, pushed up his glasses, and rubbed his eyes. "We had such a good chance," he said. "I told him what I thought, but I couldn't, in truth, say that we had more than a good chance. I guess Tom was tired of white men's chances and preferred to take his own." "Ready, Cal?"
"Yes, sir, Mr. Finch."
"Then let's go." Aunt Alexandra sat down in Calpurnia's chair and put her hands to her face. She sat quite still. She was so quiet, I wondered if she would faint. I heard Miss Morty breathing as if she had just climbed the steps, and in the dining room the ladies chattered happily. I thought Aunt Alexandra was crying, but when she took her hands away from her face, she was not. She looked weary. She spoke, and her voice was flat.
"I can't say I approve of everything he does, Morty, but he's my brother, and I just want to know when this will ever end." Her voice rose. "It tears him to pieces. He doesn't show it much, but it tears him to pieces. I've seen him when... What else do they want from him, Morty? What else?"
"What does who want, Alexandra?" Miss Morty asked.
"I mean this town. They're perfectly willing to let him do what they're too afraid to do themselves. It might lose 'em a nickel. They're perfectly willing to let him wreck his health doing what they're afraid to do. They're..."
"Be quiet. They'll hear you," said Miss Morty. "Have you ever thought of it this way, Alexandra? Whether Makem knows it or not, we're paying the highest tribute we can pay a man. We trust him to do right. It's that simple."
"Who?"
Aunt Alexandra never knew she was echoing her 12-year-old nephew. "The handful of people in this town who say that fair play is not marked white only. The handful of people who say a fair trial is for everybody, not just us. The handful of people with enough humility to think, when they look at a Negro, 'There, but for the Lord's kindness, am I.'" Miss Morty's old crispness was returning. "The handful of people in this town with background, that's who they are." Had I been attentive, I would have had another scrap to add to Jem's definition of background, but I found myself shaking and couldn't stop. I had seen Enfield Prison Farm, and Atticus had pointed out the exercise yard to me. It was the size of a football field.
"Stop that shaking," commanded Miss Morty, and I stopped. "Get up, Alexandra. We've left them long enough."
Aunt Alexandra rose and smoothed the various whalebone ridges along her hips. She took her handkerchief from her belt and wiped her nose. She patted her hair and said, "Do I show it?"
"Not a sign," said Miss Morty. "Are you together again, Jean Louise?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Then let's join the ladies," she said grimly.
Their voices swelled when Miss Morty opened the door to the dining room. Aunt Alexandra was ahead of me, and I saw her head go up as she went through the door.
"Oh, Mrs. Perkins," she said, "you need some more coffee. Let me get it."
"Calpurnia's on an errand for a few minutes, Grace," said Miss Morty. "Let me pass you some more of those dewberry tarts. You hear what that cousin of mine did the other day? The one who likes to go fishing?"
And so they went, down the row of laughing women, around the dining room, refilling coffee cups, dishing out goodies, as though their only regret was the temporary domestic disaster of losing Calpurnia. The gentle hum began again.
"Yes, sir, Mrs. Perkins, that J. Grimes Everett is a martyred saint. He needed to get married, so they ran to the beauty parlor every Saturday afternoon. Soon as the sun goes down, he goes to bed with the chickens, a crate full of sick chickens. Fred says that's what started it all. Fred says..."
Aunt Alexandra looked across the room at me and smiled. She looked at a tray of cookies on the table and nodded at them. I carefully picked up the tray and watched myself walk to Mrs. Merriweather. With my best company manners, I asked her if she would have some. After all, if Auntie could be a lady at a time like this, so could I.
This ends Disc 9, To Kill a Mockingbird, Disc 10.
Chapter 25. "Don't do that, Scout. Set him out on the back steps."
"Jem, are you crazy?
I said set him out on the back steps.
Sighing, I scooped up the small creature, placed him on the bottom step, and went back to my cot. September had come, but not a trace of cool weather with it, and we were still sleeping on the back screen porch. Lightning bugs were still about, the night crawlers and flying insects that beat against the screen the summer long had not gone wherever they go when autumn comes. A roly-poly had found his way inside the house. I reasoned that the tiny varmint had crawled up the steps and under the door. I was putting my book on the floor beside my cot when I saw him. The creatures are no more than an inch long, and when you touch them, they roll themselves into a tight gray ball. I lay on my stomach, reached down, and poked him. He rolled up. Then, feeling safe, I suppose, he slowly unrolled. He traveled a few inches on his 100 legs, and I touched him again. He rolled up. Feeling sleepy, I decided to end things. My hand was going down on him when Jem spoke. Jem was scowling. It was probably a part of the stage he was going through, and I wished he would hurry up and get through it. He was certainly never cruel to animals, but I had never known his charity to embrace the insect world.
"Why couldn't I mash him?" I asked. "Because they don't bother you," Jem answered in the darkness. He had turned out his reading light. "Reckon you're at the stage now where you don't kill flies and mosquitoes now, I reckon," I said. "Let me know when you change your mind. Tell you one thing, though. I ain't going to sit around and not scratch a red bug."
"Oh, dry up," he answered drowsily.
Jem was the one who was getting more like a girl every day, not I.
Comfortable, I lay on my back and waited for sleep. And while waiting, I thought of Dill. He had left us the first of the month with firm assurances that he would return the minute school was out. He guessed his folks had got the general idea that he liked to spend his summers in Macomb. Miss Rachel took us with them in the taxi to Macomb Junction, and Dill waved to us from the train window until he was out of sight. He was not out of mind. I missed him. The last 2 days of his time with us, Jem had taught him to swim. Taught him to swim. I was wide awake, remembering what Dill had told me. Barker's Eddy is at the end of a dirt road off the Meridian Highway, about a mile from town. It is easy to catch a ride down the highway on a cotton wagon or from a passing motorist, and the short walk to the creek is easy. But the prospect of walking all the way back home at dusk, when the traffic is light, is tiresome, and swimmers are careful not to stay too late. According to Dill, he and Jem had just come to the highway when they saw Atticus driving toward them. He looked like he had not seen them, so they both waved. Atticus finally slowed down. When they caught up with him, he said, "You'd better catch a ride back. I won't be going home for a while." Calpurnia was in the back seat. Jem protested, then pleaded, and Atticus said, "All right. You can come with us if you stay in the car." On the way to Tom Robinson's, Atticus told them what had happened. They turned off the highway, rode slowly by the dump and past the Ewell residence, down the narrow lane to the Negro cabins. Dill said a crowd of black children were playing marbles in Tom's front yard. Atticus parked the car and got out. Calpurnia followed him through the front gate. Dill heard him ask one of the children, "Where's your mother, Sam?" and heard Sam say,
"She down at Sis Stevens's, Mr. Finch. Want me run fetch her?"
Dill said Atticus looked uncertain. Then he said, "Yes," and Sam scampered off. "Go on with your game, boys," Atticus said to the children. A little girl came to the cabin door and stood looking at Atticus. Dill said her hair was a wad of tiny, stiff pigtails, each ending in a bright bow.
She grinned from ear to ear and walked toward our father, but she was too small to navigate the steps. Dill said Atticus went to her, took off his hat, and offered her his finger. She grabbed it, and he eased her down the steps. Then he gave her to Calpurnia. Sam was trotting behind his mother when they came up. Dill said Helen said, "Evening, Mr. Finch. Won't you have a seat?" But she didn't say any more. Neither did Atticus. "Scout," said Dill, "she just fell down in the dirt. Just fell down in the dirt. Like a giant with a big foot just came along and stepped on her. Just oomph!" Dill's fat foot hit the ground. "Like you'd step on an ant." Dill said Calpurnia and Atticus lifted Helen to her feet and half carried, half walked her to the cabin. They stayed inside a long time, and Atticus came out alone. When they drove back by the dump, some of the Yules hollered at them, but Dill didn't catch what they said. Makem was interested by the news of Tom's death for perhaps 2 days. 2 days was enough for the information to be spread through the county. "Did you hear about—" "No? Well, they say he was running, fit to beat lightning." To Makem, Tom's death was typical. Typical of a nigger to cut and run. Typical of a nigger's mentality to have no plan, no thought for the future. Just run blind, first chance he saw. Funny thing, Atticus Finch might have got him off scot-free. But wait. Hell no, you know how they are. Easy come, easy go. Just shows you, that Robinson boy was legally married. They say he kept himself clean, went to church and all that. But when it comes down to the line, the veneer's mighty thin. Nigger always comes out in 'em. A few more details, enabling the listener to repeat his version in turn. Then nothing to talk about until the Makem Tribune appeared the following Thursday. There was a brief obituary in the colored news, but there was also an editorial. Mr. B.B. Underwood was at his most bitter, and he couldn't have cared less who canceled advertising and subscriptions. But Makem didn't play that way. Mr. Underwood could holler till he sweated and write whatever he wanted to. He'd still get his advertising and subscriptions. If he wanted to make a fool of himself in his paper, that was his business. Mr. Underwood didn't talk about miscarriages of justice. He was writing so children could understand. Mr. Underwood simply figured it was a sin to kill cripples, be they standing, sitting, or escaping. He likened Tom's death to the senseless slaughter of songbirds by hunters and children, and Makem thought he was trying to write an editorial poetical enough to be reprinted in the Montgomery Advertiser. How could this be so, I wondered, as I read Mr. Underwood's editorial. Senseless killing. Tom had been given due process of law to the day of his death. He had been tried openly and convicted by 12 good men and true. My father had fought for him all the way. Then Mr. Underwood's meaning became clear. Atticus had used every tool available to free men to save Tom Robinson. But in the secret courts of men's hearts, Atticus had no case. Tom was a dead man the minute Mayella Yule opened her mouth and screamed. The name Yule gave me a queasy feeling. Makem had lost no time in getting Mr. Yule's views on Tom's demise and passing them along through that English channel of gossip, Miss Stephanie Crawford. Miss Stephanie told Aunt Alexandra in Jem's presence, "Oh, Foot, he's old enough to listen," that Mr. Yule said it made one down and about two more to go. Jem told me not to be afraid. Mr. Yule was more hot gas than anything.
Jem also told me that if I breathed a word to Atticus, if in any way I let Atticus know I knew, Jem would personally never speak to me again.
Chapter 26. School started, and so did our daily trips past the Radley place. Jem was in the 7th grade and went to high school, beyond the grammar school building. I was now in the 3rd grade, and our routines were so different, I only walked to school with Jem in the mornings and saw him at meal times. He went out for football, but was too slender and too young yet to do anything but carry the team water buckets. This he did with enthusiasm. Most afternoons he was seldom home before dark. The Radley place had ceased to terrify me, but it was no less gloomy, no less chilly under its great oaks, and no less uninviting. Mr. Nathan Radley could still be seen on a clear day, walking to and from town. We knew Boo was there, for the same old reason. Nobody'd seen him carried out yet. I sometimes felt a twinge of remorse when passing by the old place, at ever having taken part in what must have been sheer torment to Arthur Radley. What reasonable recluse wants children peeping through his shutters, delivering greetings on the end of a fishing pole, wandering in his collards at night? And yet, I remembered. 2 Indian head pennies, chewing gum, soap dolls, a rusty medal, a broken watch and chain. Jem must have put them away somewhere. I stopped and looked at the tree one afternoon. The trunk was swelling around its cement patch. The patch itself was turning yellow. We had almost seen him a couple of times, a good enough score for anybody. But I still looked for him each time I went by. Maybe someday we would see him. I imagined how it would be. When it happened, he'd just be sitting in the swing when I came along. "I do, Mr. Arthur," I would say, as if I had said it every afternoon of my life. "Evening, Jean Louise," he would say, as if he had said it every afternoon of my life. "Right pretty spell we're having, isn't it?" "Yes, sir, right pretty," I would say, and go on. It was only a fantasy. We would never see him. He probably did go out when the moon was down and gaze upon Miss Stephanie Crawford. I'd have picked somebody else to look at, but that was his business. He would never gaze at us. "You aren't starting that again, are you?" said Atticus one night, when I expressed a stray desire just to have one good look at Boo Radley before I died. "If you are, I'll tell you right now, stop it. I'm too old to go chasing you off the Radley property. Besides, it's dangerous. You might get shot. You know Mr. Nathan shoots at every shadow he sees, even shadows that leave size 4 bare footprints. You were lucky not to be killed." I hushed then and there. At the same time, I marveled at Atticus. This was the first he had let us know he knew a lot more about something than we thought he knew. And it had happened years ago. No, only last summer. No, summer before last, when... Time was playing tricks on me. I must remember to ask Jem. So many things had happened to us. Boo Radley was the least of our fears. Atticus said he didn't see how anything else could happen, that things had a way of settling down, and after enough time passed, people would forget that Tom Robinson's existence was ever brought to their attention. Perhaps Atticus was right, but the events of the summer hung over us like smoke in a closed room. The adults in Macomb never discussed the case with Jem and me. It seemed that they discussed it with their children,
and their attitude must have been that neither of us could help having Atticus for a parent, so their children must be nice to us in spite of him. The children would never have thought that up for themselves. Had our classmates been left to their own devices, Jem and I would have had several swift, satisfying fist fights apiece and ended the matter for good. As it was, we were compelled to hold our heads high and be, respectively, a gentleman and a lady. In a way, it was like the era of Mrs. Henry Lafayette DuBose, without all her yelling. There was one odd thing, though, that I never understood. In spite of Atticus's shortcomings as a parent, people were content to re-elect him to the state legislature that year, as usual, without opposition. I came to the conclusion that people were just peculiar. I withdrew from them, and never thought about them until I was forced to. I was forced to one day in school. Once a week we had a current events period. Each child was supposed to clip an item from a newspaper, absorb its contents, and reveal them to the class. This practice allegedly overcame a variety of evils. Standing in front of his fellows encouraged good posture and gave a child poise. Delivering a short talk made him word conscious. Learning his current event strengthened his memory. Being singled out made him more than ever anxious to return to the group. The idea was profound, but as usual, in Macomb, it didn't work very well. In the first place, few rural children had access to newspapers, so the burden of current events was borne by the town children, convincing the bus children more deeply that the town children got all the attention anyway. The rural children who could usually brought clippings from what they called the grit paper, a publication spurious in the eyes of Miss Gates, our teacher. Why she frowned when a child recited from the grit paper, I never knew. But in some way it was associated with liking fiddling, eating syrupy biscuits for lunch, being a holy roller, singing Sweetly Sings the Donkey, and pronouncing it donkey, all of which the state paid teachers to discourage. Even so, not many of the children knew what a current event was. Little Chuck Little, 100 years old in his knowledge of cows and their habits, was halfway through an Uncle Natural story when Miss Gates stopped him. "Charles, that is not a current event. That is an advertisement." Cecil Jacobs knew what one was, though. When his turn came, he went to the front of the room and began, "Old Hitler, Adolf Hitler, Cecil," said Miss Gates. "One never begins with old anybody." "Yes, ma'am," he said. "Old Adolf Hitler has been prosecuting the persecuting Cecil." "No, Miss Gates, it says here." "Well, anyway, old Adolf Hitler has been after the Jews, and he's putting them in prisons, and he's taking away all their property, and he won't let any of them out of the country, and he's washing all the feeble-minded, and..." "Washing the feeble-minded?" "Yes, ma'am, Miss Gates. I reckon they don't have sense enough to wash themselves. I don't reckon an idiot could keep himself clean. Well, anyway, Hitler's started a program to round up all the half-Jews, too, and he wants to register 'em in case they might want to cause him any trouble. And I think this is a bad thing, and that's my current event." "Very good, Cecil," said Miss Gates. Puffing, Cecil returned to his seat. A hand went up in the back of the room. "How can he do that?"
"Who do what?" asked Miss Gates patiently.
"I mean, how can Hitler just put a lot of folks in a pen like that? Looks like the government'd stop him," said the owner of the hand.
"Hitler is the government," said Miss Gates, and seizing an opportunity to make education dynamic, she went to the blackboard. She printed "Democracy"
in large letters. "Democracy," she said. "Does anybody have a definition?" "Us," somebody said. I raised my hand, remembering an old campaign slogan Atticus had once told me about. "What do you think it means, Jean Louise?" "Equal rights for all, special privileges for none," I quoted.
"Very good, Jean Louise. Very good," Miss Gates smiled. In front of "democracy," she printed, "We are a..." "Now, class, say it all together. We are a democracy."
We said it. Then Miss Gates said, "That's the difference between America and Germany. We are a democracy, and Germany is a dictatorship."
"Dictatorship," she said.
"Over here, we don't believe in persecuting anybody. Persecution comes from people who are prejudiced."
"Prejudice," she enunciated carefully.
"There are no better people in the world than the Jews, and why Hitler doesn't think so is a mystery to me."
An inquiring soul in the middle of the room said, "Why don't they like the Jews, you reckon, Miss Gates?"
"I don't know, Henry. They contribute to every society they live in. And most of all, they are a deeply religious people. Hitler's trying to do away with religion, so maybe he doesn't like them for that reason."
Cecil spoke up. "Well, I don't know for certain," he said. "They're supposed to change money or something, but that ain't no cause to persecute 'em. They're white, ain't they?"
Miss Gates said, "When you get to high school, Cecil, you'll learn that the Jews have been persecuted since the beginning of history, even driven out of their own country. It's one of the most terrible stories in history. Time for arithmetic, children."
As I had never liked arithmetic, I spent the period looking out the window. The only time I ever saw Atticus scowl was when Elmer Davis would give us the latest on Hitler. Atticus would snap off the radio and say, "Humph." I asked him once why he was impatient with Hitler, and Atticus said, "Because he's a maniac."
This would not do, I mused, as the class proceeded with its sums. One maniac and millions of German folks looked to me like they'd shut Hitler in a pen instead of letting him shut them up. There was something else wrong. I would ask my father about it. I did, and he said he could not possibly answer my question because he didn't know the answer.
"But it's okay to hate Hitler?"
"It is not," he said. "It's not okay to hate anybody."
"Atticus," I said, "there's something I don't understand. Miss Gates said it was awful, Hitler doing like he does. She got real red in the face about it."
"I should think she would."
"But..."
"Yes?"
"Nothing, sir." I went away, not sure that I could explain to Atticus what was on my mind, not sure that I could clarify what was only a feeling. Perhaps Jem could provide the answer. Jem understood school things better than Atticus. Jem was worn out from a day's water carrying. There were at least 12 banana peels on the floor by his bed, surrounding an empty milk bottle.
"What you stuffing for?" I asked. "Coach says if I can gain 25 pounds by year after next, I can play," he said.
"This is the quickest way.
If you don't throw it all up."
"Jem," I said, "I want to ask you something."
"Shoot."
He put down his book and stretched his legs. "Miss Gates is a nice lady, ain't she?"
"Why, sure," said Jem. "I liked her when I was in her room."
"She hates Hitler a lot."
"What's wrong with that?"
"Well,
She went on today about how bad it was him treating the Jews like that. Jem, it's not right to persecute anybody, is it?